Persevi wrote, the explosion that targeted the Hashd al-Shaabi's military base in central Iraq's Babil province in the wee hours of Saturday morning, April 20, had all the hallmarks of the Zionist regime as well as its Western allies. The Hashd al-Shaabi, or Popular Mobilization Forces, PMF, said the explosion at its Kalsu base, which houses both PMF and Iraqi army personnel, weapons, as well as the headquarters of the PMF chief of staff, Haj Abu Fadak, was an attack. At least one PMF soldier was killed, and other Iraqi soldiers and civilians, including a child, were injured. Iraq's military said in a statement, the Air Defense Command report confirmed through technical efforts and radar detection that there was no drone or fighter jet in the airspace of Babil before and during the explosion. The explosion hit equipment, weapons and vehicles. An Interior Ministry source was cited as saying in local media. The bombardment of the base is unlikely to have been carried out by the U.S. occupation inside the country, especially since the U.S. pledged to the government of Prime Minister Mohammad Shia Sudani that it won't target any Iraqi faction as long as their illegal bases and personnel aren't attacked. However, the assertions of another security source pointing the finger at the occupying Zionist regime are an accurate assessment. The Zionist regime has the most to benefit from it, the evidence suggests so. Iraqi authorities said there were no warplanes in the sky before or after the strike on the Kalsu base. This is likely true. It's very possible that the attack was carried out from outside Iraq, possibly through medium-range ballistic missiles launched from Syrian airspace. The Israeli regime military has the capability to conduct such operations. It has violated Syrian airspace numerous times without entering Iraqi airspace. Additionally, the aftermath of the strike strongly indicates this wasn't a drone attack. When comparing the images from Kalsu attack with other attacks in Iraq, including U.S. airstrikes against the PMF forces at Al-Qa'im in 2021, a crater with a depth of more than 3 meters in both incidents is visible. This level of damage can only be caused by a heavy missile. Even if a blast blows up ammunition and missile depots, such as the explosion that occurred at the PMF Al-Saghr military base near Baghdad in July 2020, which is much larger than the Kalsu base, with hundreds more rockets and warheads, the blast did not create a crater of this depth. Verified images on social media also showed Haj Abu Fadak holding remnants of the explosion in Camp Kalsu. The shrapnel seen is a fin of a Pei-Wei laser-guided precision missile. These are mostly used by the British, who have sold them to their allies in West Asia. The Zionist regime planned the attack and almost certainly carried it out. Did the US give its stamp of approval? Yes, without a shadow of doubt. Tel Aviv cannot escalate in a country where there are illegal U.S. bases that have been subject to some 200 attacks since the Gaza genocide began. Those attacks against U.S. bases ceased in February, allowing the resumption of talks between Baghdad and Washington with the aim of ending the long-standing U.S. occupation. Importantly, the PMF wasn't behind the 200 attacks on the illegal U.S. bases in Iraq and Syria. The Islamic Resistance in Iraq bombed the illegal American military sites in Iraq and Syria in solidarity with Gaza. When attacks on U.S. bases were suspended in February, the Iraqi resistance expanded its focus against the Zionist occupation with a flurry of drone and missile attacks in solidarity with the people of Gaza, who have been reeling under the genocidal war for almost 200 days now. 2 months ago, the Islamic Resistance in Iraq targeted vital Israeli interests every other week. These days, it is conducting near daily operations, sometimes around three attacks cripple Israeli infrastructure in a 24-hour time frame. Recently, they again targeted a key site in Eilat. Following the attack on the PMF's Qalsu base, the Islamic Resistance in Iraq swiftly retaliated by targeting the occupied Israeli port city of Eilat. The Iraqi projectiles have clearly proven a success. Even Israeli media made a rare admission lately of a drone attack from Iraq that infiltrated the occupied lands and wasn't intercepted. What Tel Aviv wants to achieve is for the Iraqi resistance to shift its attention back to targeting U.S. bases in Iraq and Syria. The United States regime is also at the moment seeking a path out of the talks with Iraqi officials amid rising demands for a swift and complete U.S. military withdrawal from the country. U.S. Secretary of Defense Lloyd Austin appears to be risking a return to American bases coming under fire rather than having to hold another round of serious talks with al-Sudani like he did recently. This is where poor strategy comes into play both by Tel Aviv and Washington. What the perpetrators of the Gaza genocide appear unable to fathom is that there is nothing that can stop or deter the resistance in Iraq, or Lebanon and Yemen for that matter, for defending Gaza and the Palestinians until the genocide ends. The U.S. regime has assassinated senior PMF commanders, while the government forces have seen their bases and soldiers come under deadly strikes since October 7th. Despite the PMF no longer being aligned with the Islamic Resistance in Iraq, like they were in the fight against Daesh terrorists between 2014 and 2017, the U.S. and its Zionist proxy entity are well aware of how popular the PMF is in the Arab country. The U.S. was quite quick to deny any responsibility, but knows from its own airstrikes on the PMF that only attacks on these popular forces can draw a significant level of public anger. It's a risky strategy for the Zionist regime and the United States. The Iraqi resistance will only increase its attacks on the Israeli interest. It is already in the process of implementing the second phase, which involves a maritime blockade of Zionist ships in the Mediterranean. As the Iraqi resistance has repeatedly warned America and the Zionist entity only understands the language of force. The resistance has nothing to lose. PMF commanders and soldiers will be mourned for 40 days, and the government forces will receive the weapons it has lost to resume ground operations against Daesh, sleeper cells, and other security duties.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم.
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints.
كتاب الله كتاب الله
ما رو هدایت میکنه.
It guides us through life.
همه چیز رو تعلیم داده.
It has taught us everything.
باید آموخت. باید فهمید.
We should learn and appreciate what it gives us.
و اونگاه پیاده کردن این مفاهیم در واقعیت زندگی است.
And try to apply them to our daily lives.
چجوری ممکنه؟
How is it possible?
نزل القرآن يهدي للتي أقوم ويبشر
از راه قرآن
by means of Quran
کتاب الله
این خوندن قرآن و تلاوت قرآن قدم اول است برادران من، این قدم آخر نیست.
Reading and recitation of the Quran is the first step, brothers, not the last one.
هو الذي أرسل رسوله بالهدى ودين.
It is he who has sent his apostle with the guidance and the religion of truth, that he may make it prevail over all religions, though the polytheists should be averse.
والذي أرسل رسوله بالهدى ودين الحق ليظهره على الدين كله ولو كره المشركون.
تلاوت قرآن با صوت خوش، با آداب که شیوه خاصی دارد، موسیقی خاصی دارد، روش خاصی دارد، اینها چیزایی لازم نیست.
Recitation of the Quran in nice tones should be performed according to particular methods and tones.
إن في ذلك لعبرة.
اما این کافی نیست.
But it's not enough.
نقيم الدين ولا تتفرقوا فيه.
مشکل بزرگ مسلمانان دنیا دوری از قرآن، دوری از قرآن، از قرآن.
Muslims major problem is losing touch with the Quran. Quran, Quran.
كتاب الله.
یعنی
بازار
Almost everything around us is either made of plastic or has some plastic component. The use of plastic products in our daily lives is so widespread that many of our regular activities require a wide range of plastic accessories and products. Plastic is everywhere, from our homes to offices, businesses and health centers. It is also used to make aeroplane parts, cars, trains and so much more. Plastic is one of the most widely used materials due to its versatile features which have boosted economies across the globe.
Well, hello there and welcome to another edition of Bazaar, the program that analyzes profits, markets, industries and all sorts of things that connect us nationally and internationally. This week, we are going to take a look at Iran's plastic production. We wanted to see how this market is doing and check out some major players in this sector. We will also peek into some of its contributions to the national economy. Enough said, let's walk through today's Bazaar.
To become more familiar with plastic products and their production, we visited Parham Plast Arya. This company has been around for many years and is a major contender in the plastic products market. It makes hundreds of plastic-based products for a variety of uses. Some products are household plastic items such as baskets, dishes, utensils, and even larger things like chairs and tables. All things considered, this company provides some of the highest quality products found in the market. This is mainly because of its choice of raw material, which is rigorously tested for quality in its control labs. Moreover, raw materials such as polymers and additives are abundant inside the country. So, it doesn't have to look far for its feedstock. One of the advantages this company has is it controls the whole production and distribution process from design to sales.
In terms of household plastic products, there's always a thirst for newer and more stylish products coming from consumers. So companies must stay on their toes and create new molds each year to offer products that excite customers. However, making new molds is not always easy, and it can be an expensive process. That's why some companies choose to import molds instead, while others develop their own in R&D departments.
This company's research and development division is at the center of all productions. It is where new products are created. It is also tasked with keeping the company up to date in several fields, including production, consumer trends, and other domestic demands. Plus, it is no surprise that this unit is also where national and international standards for safety and durability are applied. It might be interesting to know that this company was a pioneer in setting standards through some of its products nationwide. Each year, this company evaluates the market to release the most recent product designs, giving it a competitive edge over other brands. Its massive production facilities can produce thousands of tons of products each year. As part of its future vision, this company is already expanding its facilities by launching a new production line. Once this new unit is up and running, it will add some 8,000 tons to its annual production. It also hopes to create its very own high-quality molds in the near future. This firm has overcome significant challenges over the years to enjoy its many achievements. Presently, this company is operating under its potential production capacity, and its ultimate goal is to use its full potential along the lines of exports. Now, plastic is known as a group of synthetic or semi-synthetic materials created through the polymerization process. So, one of the most prominent ingredients in this mix is polymers, which are a derivative of petrochemical products that come from processing oil. It's not surprising that Iran has an ever-expanding polymer industry, given its large oil reserves. We looked at some figures from the National Plastic and Polymer Industries Association. Data showed that the polymer industry gets most of its feedstock from domestic petrochemical complexes. Plus, there are some 8,000 production units that make plastic products nationwide. These units have a total capacity to produce roughly 13 million tons annually. Some $3.3 billion worth of polymer products were exported last year. That's according to the National Plastic and Polymer Industries Association. Furthermore, it says these exports registered a 23% increase compared to the year before. The association also says exports in this sector make up roughly 7% of the country's non-oil exports. Iran's oil and petrochemical industries are subject to US-imposed sanctions. Still, the wide variety of their products and high international demand has kept the market floating. On a broader scale, switching attention to added value products to boost non-oil exports has been a transformative move for Iranian industries. Through this, the country has tapped into its advanced domestic capabilities and diversified its economy toward a knowledge-based one. Household appliances are universal and an integral part of our modern daily life. Nearly all households have some sort of appliance meant to bring ease and comfort to everyday domestic tasks. Additionally, these items assist us in preserving and preparing food, cleaning our clothes, and overall helping us stay healthy. In general, the near 100% penetration of appliances in homes shows how crucial they are for our way of life and just how abundantly available these items are.
This week, we will journey through Iran's massive home appliance industry. We wanted to see how this sector has developed over the years and check out some major players in this manufacturing arena.
To become more familiar with this sector, we decided to visit Steel Alborz Industries. It was established 30 years ago and has since become a well-known household brand. This company began its work by producing steel sinks. Later, it added to its product basket and began manufacturing stoves, ovens, stovetop ventilation systems, and taps, among other kitchen attachments. With two factories in Shiraz and one in the capital Tehran, its production facilities can make hundreds of thousands of units annually in over 200 different models. One of these factories is solely dedicated to various molds needed to create its stylishly modern products. Early on in its manufacturing journey, this company used to import steel stencil sheets from Europe. But after becoming a subsidiary of the second largest producer of galvanized steel sheets, it began purchasing most of its raw material domestically. The company uses the latest technology to manufacture its products. Its production lines are equipped with cutting-edge automated assembly systems managed by experienced staff. None the less important is the use of high-quality raw materials and strong sustainable designs are two key components in guaranteeing the long life of these kitchen appliances.
Here is a short word on the machines used in manufacturing home appliances in Iran. Many production machines and automated systems, such as steel laser cutters, are domestically produced. Of course, that's not to say all of them are locally made. Some still need to be imported, but it is noteworthy just how much of this equipment is already available in domestic markets.
Research and development and quality control are critical activities of this manufacturing company. The R&D department is responsible for developing new products as well as monitoring the market and customers' needs. Its quality control division is built into its production facilities. Here, items are frequently checked and tested with the latest technologies to ensure manufacturing uniformity. As you might know, this also guarantees that each item is made exactly the same, which increases the quality of the final product. The R&D and quality control departments are also responsible for implementing national and international standards, which led the way for its exports. Currently, this company not only distributes its products nationwide, but also sends its items to neighboring and Eurasian markets. This company largely attributes its success to its highly experienced and specialized staff, who are in charge of various production processes. On the whole, it has created numerous job opportunities directly and indirectly. Plus, it has dozens of representative agencies across the country. Like many in the home appliance industry, this company has faced many obstacles throughout the years. But its trump card has been its unique approach to solving these challenges. For example, the US-imposed sanctions were one that this company transformed into a domestic opportunity.
Now, Iran domestically produces a lot of raw materials needed in this sector, which spares local manufacturers from spending millions on imports. What's more, domestically supplying raw materials to the home appliance industry has helped it blossom. But you don't have to take my word for it. Here's an overview of the sector and its productions, including some insight into raw materials produced in Iran.
Iran is the 10th largest steel producer in the world, just behind Brazil. However, China is the undisputed producer with nearly 100 million tons of monthly output. That's just to give you an idea of how large the country's steel sector is. It's undoubtedly important, as the country's mammoth industry feeds numerous down-the-line sectors, including home appliance manufacturing. The World Steel Association's figures show that major Iranian steel mills produced nearly 30 million tons of crude steel and products last year. It might be interesting to know that over 30% of total productions are typically exported, generating millions in foreign revenue. But that's not the only industry that supplies raw materials to the home appliance sector. Petrochemical products, such as polymers, which are used to make plastic, also contribute to the production of home appliances. Iran's Home Appliances Manufacturers Union says some 15 million household appliances were produced in the country last year. That's far beyond the original production target of 12 million units set by the government. Meanwhile, Iran exports many of these products to neighboring regions, including Asia and Africa. Last year, the total value of exports was over $300 million, according to Iran's Trade Promotion Organization. All things considered, there is a lot to look forward to regarding Iran's expanding home appliance sector.
Okay, I shall now step aside for several minutes and let my good friend and colleague guide you on an educational adventure out on the field. Take it away.
Most of you have probably thought about biking to work, or biking to most places for that matter, instead of driving. You get a little workout done in your probably sedentary lifestyle, you help the environment, you don't pay for fuel during a global energy crisis, and well, frankly, you look cool. But you never actually got to doing it, or you did it a couple times and realized that it's not for you. Maybe it was too difficult. Maybe you were burned out halfway through and had to take a taxi for the rest of the way, or that you showed up too sweaty for work. If you're still, however, interested in the idea, just not so much the problems, electric bikes are just the thing for you. And just why do I say that? Well, let's imagine you are biking to work and you find yourself burned out, or you get a bad cramp and you can't pedal the bike the rest of the way. So here are your options. You take a taxi and leave the bike, which is not really an option. You go back home hoping you were less than halfway to your destination, otherwise it would be even more difficult to do that. Or wait a good while till your energy level comes back up and miss work a little bit. None of these are elegant options, really. There is one, though. You have an electric bike, so you either don't even pedal at all for the rest of the way and just use the throttle on your electric bike, or you have the bike assist your pedaling so it's not as difficult and draining. You still get a workout done, but you're not drained completely afterwards. When he said 80% of the electronic kits are made in-house, it meant that pretty much the only thing that isn't being made here is the battery test kits and the LCDs they install on the bike handles that show you your current speed, wattage used by the motor, battery level, etc. And even that has a custom software. The 500, 750 and 1000 watt motors are made in-house and are installed in the way that you are seeing right now. Regular bikes from different brands and manufacturers are taken into the facilities and then they are prepped to have everything installed on them. There are lots of types for bikes, and for each bike with its purpose, they might use a different battery capacity and motor. For example, they use a 1000 watt motor and 64 cell battery on their biggest and baddest fat bike meant for rough off-road terrain, and a 500 watt motor and a 52 cell battery for their urban bikes that don't benefit too much from the extra horsepower. I mean, it's not actually horsepower, but you know what I mean. The process that goes behind turning mundane regular bikes that are great for a workout to one that is not as good for a workout, but is a lot more convenient and a lot more capable of transporting you from one place to another. So first, they need to cut some holes into the chassis, precision holes into these oftentimes aluminum chassis, to make room for the connections between the controller as well as the throttle on the handle and the battery pack. So once they have installed, now it's time for the electric motor, which is going to be installed on the rim. So they take the rim off, they disassemble all of the spokes on the rim,
they reinstall it on the electric motor. But there's a crucial step here. They need to make sure that the screws of the spokes that are connected to the rim as well as the electric motor are completely balanced so that the rim doesn't skew to one side or the other. So they spin it to make sure it doesn't touch two screws on both sides. If it does touch it and there's friction, they need to re-tighten or re-loosen some of the screws to make sure it's completely balanced. And now, which is designed for the 500 watt electric motor, this is the entire system with the battery pack installed and the controller also attached, as well as the throttle. But there's also another cool thing about this particular display and this whole system, but I'll reserve that for just a few minutes after we talk to one of the people behind this project to give us a little bit more information.
As an engineer and environmental enthusiast, I've always looked for a product to simultaneously save the health of the people and save the environment. And that's why I started a company called EVTech to manufacture electric bicycles in Iran. Currently, we are the largest e-bike manufacturer in Iran, and our bikes are tailor-made to Iranian trains. And people can use them here in our mountainous cities like Tehran easily. Our bikes are ranging from fat bikes, mountain bikes, and city bikes, and have different motors with different output powers. So you can choose from our products based on your need and your applications. At the core, we are a company that mainly manufactures power electronic components of e-bikes and electric motorcycles. We are manufacturing power electronics chargers, power electronic e-bike controllers, and also design brushless DC motors that have been used in our products and electric motors that manufactured by other companies. We also manufacture our battery packs and use very, very sophisticated battery management systems to ensure that our batteries are working in their ideal conditions and are safe to use in everyday basis.
This is the last bit of information that I said I'd be talking about before. So the bike has its regular set of gears. You got the back gears and the front gears. But then there's display, and with this number that shows a assistive gear, let's call it. So when the number is on zero, when you pedal for like one round, it doesn't assist you at all. But as the number goes up, it assists you more and more. So if you pedal the same amount and the number is on like three, it pushes you a lot further than if this number was set to zero. This is great for those times when you feel like you're really burned out and you can't pedal that much, especially when you're in an upward slope. So you increase this number, you get more assistance from the electric motor to push yourself forward a lot more. Now it's time for me to take it for a quick little spin. So this throttle is the difference between enjoying bike riding and not so much enjoying it and looking at it as a chore and just a workout. I have been like one of the people that I mentioned at the beginning of the program, the type that wants to bike to more places but doesn't do it because I find myself burned out too quickly when I'm going up a slope. With this, I can enjoy the flat surfaces and the downward slopes in biking, which are a lot more enjoyable than the upward slopes, and just skip the difficult slopes. So I'm seriously considering getting one of these electric bikes myself. And with that, we have come to the end of the program. Until next week.
What an awesome report, as always. Many thanks. Well, that covers today's Bazaar. I have been Samson Sees. Sees you in the next Bazaar.
Iranian Radio, Global Mission. This is IRIB English Radio.
Migration is everybody's right. All people are free to look for some other places to reach their hopes and ambitions. From long ago, humans have searched for new places where they could live better. Today, you can achieve this aim more easily. People can immigrate to other countries to achieve their goals. Iran is a popular country among immigrants. There are those who may choose this country for their pursuing their education, as well as those who may find it a suitable place to live because of its weather, culture, and civilization.
اسمم فخریه کریم کارادومان هست.
My name is Fakhriye Karim Karadoman, and I was born in Azerbaijan, in one of the villages close to the Iranian border. I spent my elementary, secondary, and high school years there. Then I went to Istanbul and got my bachelor's degree in Persian language and literature from Istanbul University. After that, I came back to Azerbaijan to get my master's degree from Baku State University. Then I got married. My husband is from Turkey. We've been married for 5 years. We live in Şanlıurfa city. My husband is a policeman. In Turkey, there is a great need for professors of Persian language and literature. So I decided to come to Iran to do a PhD. My father likes Iran a lot. Most of his relatives live here. He's also interested in the Persian language. He wanted to study Persian, but he was not admitted to any university. He teaches history now. He wanted me to study Persian. At first, I only wanted to make his wish come true, but then I myself became interested in Persian.
Fakhriye is a hard-working woman, and Persian has already become a part of her life. She leaves no point unanswered with her questions. She has decided to teach Persian language and culture in Turkey after finishing her studies.
When we were kids, my father taught us Persian alphabet so we could read and write in it. We had learned a couple of words too. He taught us some poems by Sa'di. Overall, I was familiar with the Persian language.
کنون ای خردمند وصف خرد بدین جایگه گفتن اندر خورد.
Among our courses, I like epic literature more than others. We studied شاهنامه. I like it very much and it's easier for me compared to the other courses such as mystic, classic or lyrical literature. Shahnameh's language, or indeed Ferdowsi's language, is easy and enjoyable. I bought a CD that reads Shahnameh. Every day I listen to it for 5 or 10 minutes. It's really beautiful.
There are many immigrants in this country. Mrs. Orbadov, a Romanian dentist, is one of them. She is a thoughtful woman, and Islam has been one of her main reasons for immigration. Now it's been more than 15 years that she's been living in Iran.
I always felt I was not satisfied with my life. I mean, I wanted to find something more exciting. It's not enough just to study and graduate in a special major, then get married and have children. I knew there to be a bigger picture. I studied a bit about Asian religions like Hinduism and Buddhism. I also read about Christianity, which is the dominant religion among Romanians, including my own family. These studies were interesting, and I was hoping to find an answer to my questions in books. To be honest, our Romanian religious leaders are more of symbolic figures and do not have much to say in matters relating to religions and science. So I tried other ways to answer my questions. When I was a freshman, I made friends with some Muslim students. I borrowed some books from them. These books were not many because only a few books had been translated into Romanian. They had quotes from Quran and I could find answers to my questions. It was the period of big changes in my life. I read so many books and had lots of discussions with my Muslim friends. By the end of my freshman year, I had already become a Muslim. One of the God's biggest mercies for me was that among my friends at the university, there were Shiites, Sunnis, and Wahhabis. I mean, there were a variety of Islamic sects. My Shiite friends seemed the most rational ones. That's why I became Shia. Considering some concepts like religious leaders and Shiism, I wanted to know if there was a society of Muslims, even small, designed this way. So I decided to immigrate to Iran, and my main motivation was to get familiar with the learn about Shiism. However, I thought that Iran was experiencing its post-war period and had lots of problems. I had read a story from Betty Mahmoudi about Iran. I thought that living in Iran is really tough, like there's no gas pipeline for houses, or I would have to make fire to have hot water to wash the dishes. I thought that the streets are all ruined and buildings are just under reconstruction. But I was really surprised when I came to Iran. I saw that people here are living an ordinary life like in other countries.
Mrs. Orbadov mentions a few facts about her country, including the current chauvinism that has marginalized women and their rights. She believes that in Iran, women can work very easily just as men can, and they too can claim their rights.
After I became a Muslim, I began to see women differently. As a young girl, I discovered a new image of women. In this viewpoint, women are highly respected. They are valued for who they actually are. All female qualities such as emotions and sensitivity are looked down on in my country. These were considered as signs of weakness. So my friends and I were trying to get rid of them. Instead, we tried to adopt male behaviors and thinking because they were more appreciated.
She lives with her only daughter and her husband who is studying abroad. She's happy that she has finally found a safe place for her hopes and aspirations.
I was a sophomore studying dentistry. My husband was studying medicine back then. We had known each other before I became a Muslim. He proposed to me after I became a Muslim and we got married. We lived in Romania for 5 years before coming to Iran, and after I got my travel permit, we moved here. Then our daughter was born. She is about 17 years old now. My daughter is too happy about living in Iran. We travel to Romania to visit my family once in a while. My daughter likes both countries. My daughter and I think similarly, and this makes me happy. For example, it could have happened that my daughter did not believe in Islam, but it makes me happy to see that she too believes in it and acts accordingly.
I have lots of friends here in Iran. Iranians are very kind and hospitable. Everywhere I go, I have some friends. Isfahan, Shiraz, Mashhad, Qom, or Kermanshah.
Raja, the Pakistani immigrant, has come to Iran to study art. He's a painting student now. He spends most of his time studying art. Watching other artists' works is his best pastime.
I spend most of my time at the university.
I come to the library. I spend time on the campus, which has a nice and beautiful atmosphere. There are only graduate students here, and they are all here to learn. The atmosphere of Tarbiyat Modares University is nice and pleasant, something I haven't seen elsewhere. I really enjoy reading in Persian. I think Persian has harmony. It has music. It's pleasant to read in Persian and listen to it.
Fakhriye is interested in Persian music and she's been learning how to play daf, an Iranian instrument, since she came to Iran. She has also made a lot of progress. In addition to her Persian language studies, she wanted to have some experiences in Persian music. Every day, Dr. Orbidov starts her work passionately. She cares a lot about people, the people who are now her fellow countrymen, and have become one of the most important parts of her life now. Other than being a responsible dentist, she loves to spend time with her family. She tries to strike a balance between her professional and family life.
I'm a dentist. I'm very busy during most of my working hours. I have lots of patients. In the neighborhood where I work, women and kids prefer to have a female dentist. So most of my patients are women. Some patients have financial problems and thus can't pay. In these cases, all of my colleagues and I treat them free of charge. These are moral issues, and fortunately, we're all willing to participate. We do it together as a team. Generally, I think it is very important not to spend all my time at work, but to dedicate half my day to my family.
I'm Abdul Sattar Sheikh from Pakistan, Sindh province. I had a strict religious and traditional family. Our province, Sindh, has been home to an ancient civilization. My mom is a housekeeper and my father is a teacher. He teaches English language and sometimes physics. My parents wanted their children to experience an academic atmosphere and go to college. I got my diploma in sciences. My parents wanted me to be an engineer. I was interested in art and I wanted to choose a country with a cultural heritage. India, Pakistan and Iran are Eastern countries with similar cultures. I traveled to Iran once or twice before moving here and I'd seen its academic environment. Iran has a very progressive art, architecture, lifestyle, everything is good. Since I couldn't speak Persian at first, I passed my Persian language and pre-university courses at Imam Khomeini University in Ghazvin. First, I finished my Persian language courses and then I finished my pre-university. When you finish your pre-university, you can be admitted to a university. The Persian language course that I took in Imam Khomeini University was really helpful. Then I went to the Faculty of Arts at Tehran University to study for my bachelor's degree.
My husband was here with me when I came to enroll at the university. He stayed with me for 15 days and checked out the university. He's very happy that I'm studying here. We went to Qazvin and Mashhad together. He says that he has no worries about me being here. If it were any other country, he might not let me come. He says that it's safe here. I live in the dormitory. It's located on the campus. We are 12 girls in a dorm suite. They're all doing their master's degree. My roommate and I share a room. She's from Afghanistan. There are three of us in my class. One of us is Mr. Sufi from India. The other is Mrs. Farizeh from Kazakhstan. Most of the times we study together. It helps us a lot. We sometimes ask our Iranian friends who are studying literature to help us. As I mentioned, one of my classmates is Mr. Sufi from India. We study together most of the times. He lives with his family here on the campus. His Persian is much better than ours. I think it's because he has been living here for 8 or 9 years. He's a teacher in an Indian school. His Persian is excellent. He knows a lot, and I use his help.
Fakhriye has some other friends from other countries in the university. Sometimes they study together and help each other. Persian language has become their binding thread.
IRIB English Radio. This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.